Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We're back this time around to continue our Lord of the Rings reread, starting off this time with the third part of our reread here, which will be continuing with the beginning of the second half of the Fellowship of the Ring. It will technically be titled Chapter 1, Many Meetings, through Chapter 5, The Bridge of Khazad-dûm. But just to be clear, this is like Chapter 6 in the book of the Fellowship of the Ring. My name is Zach, also known as Alias, on the various internet places that are our home. And joining me, we have Mary.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary, and I'm Miria. And I take this opportunity to thank you, Zach, for taking this on, because I don't really have the time to host and edit this one. So, yay. Thank you.
Of course. And we have Alex.
Hi, my name is Alex, also known as iWendiel, on various internet places.
And Adam.
This is Adam Drownsnow online.
Online, that's where we are. All right. Thank you all so much for joining me for this. So we will be continuing, of course, starting with Chapter 1, Many Meetings, which is when we will wake up with Frodo in the House of Elrond. So I will get us started with the summary for this. So this will all be in the past tense, by the way, which is very different from what we normally do. So when Frodo awoke, he was in the House of Elrond at Rivendell. Gandalf was there. Elrond had called a council meeting to discuss what had to happen. Gandalf told Frodo that the Black Riders were also known as Ringwraiths, or the Nine Servants of the Lord of the Rings. Gandalf also explains to Frodo how the Black Riders were defeated at the Fort of Brunnen through Elrond's magic. Frodo found that for the past 4 days and 3 nights he had been delirious. He learned that Elrond, a master healer, had been at work trying to save him. The rider that had wounded Frodo had done so with a Morgul knife, and a piece of the knife had been still stuck in Frodo's body. That piece had worked its way toward his heart, but Elrond had removed it just in time. If the fragment had reached Frodo's heart, he would have become like the riders, a servant to Sauron. The ring would have been taken from him, which would have been a disaster for Frodo and the rest of Middle-earth. Frodo learned about all those who worked for the Dark Lord. The men were made of nothing and were ropes to give shapes to their otherwise shapeless existences. The horses, just like many orcs, trolls, kings, and men, had been brought up under the Dark Lord's power, and they were in his service forever. Gandalf told Frodo that the white figure he had seen at the river was Glorfindel, and that the river itself was commanded by Elrond. Elrond hosted a great feast for his guests. At the feast, Frodo spoke with the dwarf Gloin, who told Frodo who had told Frodo what had become of the dwarves Bilbo had known during his adventures. Frodo also saw Arwen for the first time. After the feast, Frodo went to the Hall of Fire along with the other guests. To his delight, Frodo discovered that Bilbo was living there among the others. Frodo had been told what he had been up to and asked to see the ring. When Frodo produced it, Bilbo at once asked him to put it away, fearful of the way he had responded to it. Strider returned and Frodo discovered that he was also called Dúnedain. Bilbo performed his song of, I can never say this word, Arendil? I think that's how you say it, I don't know. And one of the elves sang the hymn of Elbereth Gilthoniel. Alright, so that is our first chapter. This is us after our tense experience on the Fords trying to escape the Nine. We are safely in Rivendell, which is a relief. So, what do you guys think about this moment, kind of sanctuary that we get in the House of Elrond in Rivendell, right after this particularly dangerous leg of this journey that we are on with Frodo and the other hobbits?
Well, it feels very nice and very comfortable, right? And we, like, I really like this moment because all throughout, like, this chapter and the next also, we finally get a bit of explaining for where was Gandalf that comes in the Council of Elrond chapter, but already here we finally see Gandalf again, basically. And I, for one, I'm just as relieved as Frodo to finally see Gandalf again and hear what has been going on, because the previous chapters you felt like it was very scary, right? You're running from the Nine, and it's you don't have your usual guide. So yeah, it feels just we really are in Frodo's mindset, and we feel very relieved to be here.
Yeah, and it's nice to get like a follow up on The Hobbit a bit. You know, if you start connecting the books with the some information about the the dwarves that Bilbo knew, and we get more of that obviously later. But
the theme of Gandalf and the sort of sanctuary that he himself provides to Frodo and the other characters is something that I think is consistent throughout all of these chapters, and of course it ends with that sanctuary being taken away. And it is sort of like a stepping stone for Frodo and for everyone in the Fellowship to kind of reckon with the fact that he will not always be there. But in this moment here, it is so nice after, like you say, Mary, that tension and that fear of running, and that genuine, like, even when I of course, I know what happens, and I've read this a few times, but even so, you really feel that experience Frodo has where he's like, where's Gandalf? I thought he would be with me on this journey. So when you wake up here in Rivendell and you see him there and he's ready to explain things and help get things on track, you really feel that strongly every time. So that's just really effective and nice sort of pacing by Tolkien and just kind of mixing up the moments of tension, the moments of danger, and the moments of relief.
Yeah, and you also feel Frodo's idea that he's arrived to, like, the goal of his quest, because at this point he doesn't have a goal other than Rivendell. Like, all this time they've been trying to get the ring to Elrond, and then, like, supposedly they're going to hand it over and it won't be their business anymore. Like, we know better than that, but it's sort of the conclusion to, like, this first arc, leaving the Shire and going through all of these stressful situations.
That's a good point, and I think it's interesting because it's sort of forgotten, I think, sometimes when we read these books, that Frodo, like you say, thinks this is the end. Like, this is the quest. He made it here, and it's done, and we're good, and he can go home. And that sort of underscores, as we move forward into the next chapter, the sacrifice he makes to actually be willing to take the next step in the journey, which is even more perilous than what we've already experienced, which, as we've said, was terrifying and scary, and it wounded Frodo, as we learn here, in a way that will never really fully heal. So the fact that he makes that choice, and we'll get into that more later, is remarkable. It's a remarkable act of selflessness by him. And I think I've said on previous ones, I think Frodo is underrated as a character. And I think, you know, we, of course, we love Sam and we love the things he does, and we love Aragorn, we love Gandalf, but I think Frodo is really the heart of this story.
Yeah, it's easy to forget because it kind of comes naturally to him almost. I thought when I read this chapter, which is one of the few that I've read for today, that it was quite interesting. It goes well with Gandalf's character and the idea that he is wise, he knows how to help, that when Frodo awakens, like, Gandalf knows already what he's been through, and he knows, like, about the barrow, for instance. And I thought that part of the telling was quite interesting, when Gandalf is like, yeah, this was, like, probably the worst moment, and the when it could all have been lost just then in the barrow. And I find that very interesting, that we get a glimpse of how powerful and how Gandalf knows everything, or at least a lot of things. And I'm not entirely sure on how he knows this, but it's, because it cannot just be because Frodo talks in his sleep, right?
Yeah, that was kind of a weird explanation that Frodo was... I guess it's fine. It's a fantasy story. It's whatever. But just that Frodo was, like, recounting everything that had happened while he was in a coherent fashion while he was sleeping.
He just doesn't want Frodo to know that he's, like, mind-melding him.
Yeah.
You talk.
Well, yeah.
Magically. Well, there is a certain element of the sort of... I noted this. It's sort of like Dumbledore. Of course, people love to do that comp. But Dumbledore in Harry Potter, where he's, like, hiding information from Harry and, like, manipulating him to a certain extent, where, like I was saying, like, we learn the full extent of the damage wrought by the Borgul Blade, but Gandalf doesn't tell that to Frodo fully. He just thinks it. Like, we go into his head and we hear him thinking that, but he doesn't actually say that to Frodo. He doesn't really explain, like, what it's going to be like, which, of course, I think has good intentions. He doesn't want him to, like, at this moment, have to fully reckon with what this means for him, but at the same time, it's like, why not just tell him, you know? Why not just give him the whole scoop? It reminded me a lot of the whole Dumbledore situation.
Gandalf's very Entish, like, he doesn't waste time, or he doesn't...
Right, he's very efficient.
I think it's more pronounced here than in kind of newer fantasy writing that stems from this, and, like, because Tolkien's, you know, very old school. He comes from a world where you didn't just, you know, hop on a plane and go places, right? And his characters don't do that either. I mean, even a lot of modern fantasy, they're riding horses or they've got, you know, whatever their means of travel is. You're with them the whole time, and oftentimes stuff happens really quick. And, I mean, in the movie, it's like Gandalf's like, oh, shit, this is not safe. And he leaves, and it seems like it's all, like, a weekend where this happens. And, of course, this takes, like, months and years. This whole thing is, like, really, really drawn out. I mean, even, you know, we'll get to it in the next chapter, but... You know, the fact that he wasn't just gone for, like, a little bit, the fact that, like, he probably had a couple months where they were expecting him to show back up makes the fact that he's not there, I mean, even more pronounced. Because, you know, things just don't, they don't just happen in this world. Like, you know, like, Frodo could have been sitting around for, you know, a year, like, well, I don't know, maybe I should go. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's just a very different pacing.
Which is kind of what he does. At first, right, like, right. He stays for, like, 6 months in the Shire after Gandalf.
There's no urgency him. Like there is, like they put, you know, into the film. And, I mean, you know that when you read it, and every time I read it, it just sort of reminds me, because, again, like, pretty much any modern fantasy you read isn't going to do that so much, even if there are parts of the journey or parts of the story that take big portions. It's like, you know, they do a time jump, or it's urgent, or, like, but this just sort of feels like, you know, Frodo was, like, you know, hitting the pipeweed, and, you know, then we learned Gandalf was just, like, you know, all over the world, but, you know, I mean, because it takes time, you know, he can't just, like, I'm going to be in Gondor tomorrow, you know, like, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, like, Tolkien also does this, in this journey, you've got moments where everything is written out, and you see that they are staying there 2 months, and it takes a long time, and all right, but you also have moments where from one sentence to the next, 2 weeks have passed, and we are right on to the next bit of the story, because nothing really happened in those 2 weeks, so you don't necessarily have to spend hours writing about it.
Yeah, I think the difference for me between, and I think what you're saying, Adam, is totally true, that it feels different from other types of fantasy in terms of actually acknowledging sort of the time it takes to do things. I think for me, like, the key piece is that it's not just time skips, but, like, it's an acknowledgement by the characters that, like, there is a certain inertia at place. Like, this, like, initially with leaving the Shire, like, that takes a really long time, of course, to just prepare and to leave, and they don't want to leave the Shire. Like, it's actually hard to leave. Whereas in most fantasy, or, like, the movies or whatever, like you say, there's just this, like, urgency, like, we got to get on the quest. Yeah, we got to go. And that's kind of how it feels. It's like, all right, we got to go now.
Everything feels earned.
Yeah.
Tolkien. I mean, really, that's the way I'd put it. It's just like, I don't know. It's like I said, it's a weird pacing, because a lot of people are like, I don't want to deal with this, so we have a magical portal. Like, they just, you know, they can get wherever they want as quick as they want. Or, you know, the eagles show up, you know, every other chapter to ferry them around. Like, that's sort of the trick that a lot of writers, I think, use. They have a balloon, or they have, you know, a flying horse, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and as we get on the journey here, the journey is an absolute pain in the ass. Like, they're constantly facing setbacks and reversals that make it hard.
Modern video games, where it's like you've got fast travel for everything, and if suddenly you were playing a giant open world game that was like, no, you've got to walk there, and it takes you like 5 hours, like an old school MMO or something.
You know? You actually have to, it's like photorealistic how long you're taking.
Right. It's 10 miles away, so just like hit start and come back later.
So connected to all this, I wanted to explore this idea that Frodo brings up in this chapter. Speaking about Gandalf, and speaking about, like, these certain people in the story that Frodo observes as kind of being different from other men, or rather different from other big people, as he says, and he notes Aragorn as being like this, and Gandalf being like this, and of course they are special, Gandalf is, of course, an Istari. He comes from this ancient realm where all life came from, and he's very important, and he has a quest that needs to be completed, etc. He is basically a godlike creature. And in Aragorn's case, he is a man of Numenor, an ancient land that was also used to exist, not anymore, and he is special. He is special blood. He is an important person. And I just was curious about this idea. Like, how do you guys feel about this notion of some people in the story being sort of destined to be nobler and wiser than others, just like because of their blood or their background or where they came from? Like, there's just certain people in the story that are special. Like, how do you respond to that as an element of the story?
I feel like it's definitely true with Aragorn and Gandalf, but also with characters like Saruman or Sauron or even Denethor, who's more like gray. But there's also this sense that you can tell who the good big people are based on how they treat like smaller people, like big and small not being just relative to size, but
influence and power,
status and stuff. Because like Aragorn and Gandalf, they treat Frodo and the Hobbits just like they would some elven king or like other important people. But you get the sense that Saruman thinks he's above everybody else because he's a powerful wizard, and so that makes him a bad guy. And this chapter really, I think, shows like the fact that Aragorn, we've seen him so far as being like the stranger in nature and all that, but now that we're in Rivendell, we see that he has a pretty high status and nice clothes and all that, but he's still the same strider that the hobbits met along the way.
Yeah, because even someone like Elrond is like, you know, maybe like a little stuck up and maybe kind of like, you know, I mean, he's a, you know, extremely old elf, but he still treats them pretty well, I mean, all in all. So he's a good dude.
Yeah, I think Elrond kind of gets a bad rap in the movies. Like, I think he comes off as a lot more of an asshole in those for some reason, where he's really, I mean,
I think also, well, we were just coming off of like the Matrix.
Right. So with, Mr. Yeah.
Agent Smith. And so they're like, man, Agent Smith is an ass.
Yeah, it might be a little bit of residual effect and just Hugo Weaving in general, how he presents himself. But I think it's also just like, it's hard to portray elves, like, because they do have this sense of being separate from others, and you get that in the books. Like, they really feel like they're above everything. There's even that comment in this chapter where they're talking about like the history of men and little people, and they're like, we don't study that shit, we don't know about that. Like, that doesn't matter to us, that is below our concern. And they are just like that, but at the same time, like, they're not like assholes. They're concerns and their way of viewing the world is different. I think that's how I would look at it. And someone like Elrond, I think, is concerned with the realm of men and the realm of mortal things, and I think he does come across as genuinely caring. And of course, he has this power, this influence, but at the same time, he has that, I think, that goodness comes across too.
Yeah, I agree. But like, I also agree with what both Alex and Adam have said, but still, I think like Aragorn can be a bit of he's nice and he wants to do good, but he can be a bit aristocratic as well, even though he's saying that he had a simple life in a sense that he's not so accustomed to like to luxury and to being a king. But the way he talks about the people in Bree, for instance, and the simple people that he's protecting with the rangers. Yeah, it's not terrible. Like, it's not awful, but there is still the idea that some people are never going to be important in the bigger picture, and others are going to be. And even though we have the hobbits who feel more like us, and it feels like they are the ones who should not have been important, and yet they are, they're still, Frodo too still feels like he was destined to be this brave and wise hobbit, because he's the nephew of Bilbo and he's connected to all this. So I don't know, I feel a bit uncomfortable with that, because there is definitely the idea that because of their blood, and only because of their blood, they are just bigger and more like smarter, and they can go the wrong way, like Saruman, but still there's something, there's a definite hierarchy and nobility in this world that's I don't know if we would write it this way now.
Yeah.
And maybe it makes sense from Tolkien's time, but it's a bit uncomfortable when you really dig deep into this idea of fate and
And even the way that Elrond speaks about the quest they're about to embark on, there is this sense of fate and destiny of who's going to be on it and how it's going to go, and like it needs to be nine figures, etc. Yeah, I mean, it is something, it's complicated to kind of sort out, even just personally, how I feel about all that. The idea of predestiny, the idea of certain people, as you say, Mary, as being just special, as being different, as being more noble or more good just by their nature. It's not something that I think that we, like in our contemporary life, want to think is a thing, and it really isn't. But it's interesting that it gets portrayed here, and it might be, you know, it might be just a piece of like fantasy. I'm not sure. Like, I think there is a certain element of like the idea of like people or certain things that are mythic and fantastic, and there's something exciting about people like Gandalf or people like Aragorn who are just mysterious and powerful. And they're just different. Like, I think there's something about that that's fun, but at the same time, you do get that kind of uncomfortable feeling of like, but why are they? Why does no one else get to do this? You know.
I think in a sense, it's almost a trade-off. Like, we have the way the story is told is very realistic in that sense that we were just talking about the way they he takes the time to describe what's happening, because yes, it takes time to go from there to there, and he doesn't take shortcuts in this way. But on the characters themselves, you have very unrealistic characters in a sense, because they don't really, yes, they evolve, but you can see where they're going, and they're just less connected to us than characters in more modern fantasy probably, and but that's okay. But I think it's really something about the myth that Tolkien is trying to tell, and it goes back to something you were saying in the very first podcast, I think, Zach, that here Tolkien needs these characters to tell the story and not the other way around. Like, it's he has the story and he needs the right characters to be in the right spots. So he's not going to develop the story around the characters, but rather the other way around. And I think that fits and it's fine, but it's a bit weird when you're more used to newer things.
Yeah, when you're telling a story that's meant to feel like a myth, things are just going to feel different than the kind of stories that are written now. It's some characters are just going to have that kind of mythical resonance to them, and they're just going to have that weight to them, and that sense that they are kind of like even Gandalf is described here as like like Elrond says that his burdens or whatever will be done when he is done here. Like, he has a mission and he's going to do it, and like that's his primary concern. And of course he has human elements to him, and Aragorn has plenty of human elements to him. He's actually a very fascinating character on his own, but they also have this sort of just this inevitability of their mythic quality too. But I do think, like you said, that you know, of course Frodo, he is different from other hobbits. He is special in some fashion, but I do think that they are the essential part of the story that makes it work, because at the end of the day, the hobbits are down to earth. They feel more like people to us. They feel more like the typical protagonist where you can relate to them very easily. I think that works. Like, I think that helps to tie it all together in a way where you can have these mythic figures, but you also have the hobbits to kind of carry the emotional weight and the sort of typical experience of being an outsider looking in and having to cope with all these big, crazy things happening around you. All right, what else do we got on this chapter? We get a full introduction of the dwarves here, as Gloin recounts, as you said, Adam, what's going on with them, and with, of course, the dwarves that were on the journey in The Hobbit. I'm kind of curious, as we get here and we meet dwarves for the first time in The Lord of the Rings, what does everyone think of dwarves as a fantasy race? What do we think about them?
Like Tolkien dwarves or just dwarves in general?
Well, it's interesting because sort of the notion of this kind of dwarf, of course, there's a folklore and myth that it was based on, but it kind of was like this very specific interpretation of dwarves as being like this race where they like mine into the mountains and they make these great things and stuff. It was fully fleshed out by Tolkien, I think, and it's been used in tons of stuff since. So, of course, that's one aspect of his influence over the genre, but I don't know, just curious about his dwarves and what they are like.
Yeah, I love me some dwarves. Like, I'll be honest. I mean, The Hobbit was my favorite book as a kid, so yeah. I like the dwarves that, you know, they live in the mountains, they live in the caves or mines or whatever, you know. Good with an axe. You know. Gotta be good with an axe.
I think they're quite I love them because they are not like remote from the world like elves. The elves are. Yeah. And they are I think I find them more approachable than men too. From the Hobbit.
Interesting.
From the Hobbit's point of view. Yeah, I don't know if it's just because of like, this the conversation.
Literally they are closer to the earth.
I don't mean that, but I mean like the size difference isn't as much, so maybe they feel less intimidated or you know.
Well,
I don't know.
Maybe, but just I mean, it's probably a lot because of this conversation specifically and the link between hobbits and dwarves since The Hobbit. The way Gloin is telling Frodo about everything that's been going on and you can see that he's proud to tell him about what they did and what they built and the weapons they made and I find that like very relatable in a way, and the men they feel less aristocratic than the men we meet because at least here, because both Boromir and Aragorn are quite high in the hierarchy, and Gloin is too, but he feels more down to earth as well.
Yeah, I think I totally have this.
Just talking about dwarves with friends today, actually, and we were talking about how dwarves are sort of the engineers in Norse mythology, but also in Tolkien. Like they're all about making stuff and like building mines and getting materials, and so like literally they're down to earth, but also it makes them maybe more modern and more relatable to us as readers in the 20th and the 21st century.
Except there are no dwarf
men who are like warriors and kings and stuff, because we don't really relate with that kind of life.
They feel like they've been pigeonholed in fantasy a lot. Like it's the blacksmith or the woodcutter, and like it's like the token dwarf in a lot of stories.
Yeah, but here we see they like they move around. They can like go off and open another mine or go back to an abandoned mine and do their stuff. And it's kind of reminiscent of how like today you can move to a different city to get a job, and like they're not like stuck in one place like the elves are or the men are. Feels like
they've
they're
got,
more.
They've got a rich history in Tolkien. And is it? I mean, they have, they have their lines of succession, but it also feels more like they require like support of the people more than the men do in Tolkien.
What do you mean by that exactly?
It feels like there's less distance between like the hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, like they seem to be more connected, but also because they don't have these big strongholds necessarily, I guess, all these big cities and, you know, well-established countries and all that necessarily. Like, a lot of them were nomadic or driven from their homes. So they seem to kind of, you know, like, the leader seems to rely more on, like, being a good leader than just being, like, I'm the king, I guess.
Yeah, and this probably isn't true. I'm sure, like, Gloin and Gimli have, like, noble lineage and all that. I don't really know the lore, but, like, they feel just like dudes to us versus people like Boromir or Faramir,
right,
or what have you, that they feel like they're very important among men, as you were talking about, Mary. And yeah, I think, like, most of the men we meet in the story are, like, people with, like, this great weight of tragedy, it feels like, to them. Like, that's a lot of their stories, like the tragedy of men and the fall of men, and this feeling that they're diminished from what
they're
once were, etc. And the dwarves just feel like they're simply vibing, you know, they're just living their best life kind of thing. So yeah, I can see that.
They learn to roll with it a bit more. I mean, maybe being more nomadic, having less of a stake in, like, one area, or, like, having less physical possessions as well, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, there's something, of course, about, like, the fact that that they kind of get pigeonholed maybe into particular attributes and traits of what they're about, which, you know, is unfortunate, but at the same
time,
like, I think
drink and sing.
At the same time, I think they're interesting. The characters themselves, I feel, are really fleshed out. Like, I actually really like Gimli in the books. And he's quite different, actually, from how he is in the movie. But I think they're both good in different ways. But we'll get to that later. All right, I think that's about it for chapter one of this grouping. I think, of course, the songs that we get at the end, a very long song about Arendel, which I like. But yeah, it's a song. All right.
Oh. I did not read it.
Yeah.
Just let me be honest here. I don't read the songs when they are more than two characters.
It was epic. Yeah.
Who reads them? We sing them.
Exactly.
Right, it's more fun to hear them. Like, I usually, like, go look at a YouTube video or something of actually someone singing them, and it usually makes them more fun, naturally. Yeah, I think one last thing I'll say is that we get a pretty interesting little bit of philosophy here from Bilbo. He says, "Don't adventures ever have an end?" I suppose not. So it's an interesting point because, of course, in real life, we want things to be like stories where there's definitive ends and we're like, all right, I accomplished that thing and I'm done. But that's not really how life works. Life is just an adventure that never ends. Essentially, it ends. But, you know, like, there's no, like, definitive within life, an end point that you're like, all right, I did it. I'm accomplished. I can be done and I can relax and enjoy the sunset or what have you. And I think that is a good point, and it is a important thing to remember that, like, there's not just definitive endpoints in life where you can say, all right, I'm done. it's an ongoing journey. All right, chapter two, The Council of Elrond. Prepare yourselves for a very long summary, which I will read.
I shall gird my loins.
Here we go.
Do you want someone else to read it, or?
I'll do this one, and how about you take chapter three?
All right.
As we get there. All right. Here we go. The day after the feasting to celebrate the victory at the Ford of Brunnen, Frodo, joined by his uncle Bilbo and Gandalf in the gardens of Rivendell, he is hoping to explore the area. He was instead told by Gandalf that a great council was about to begin and that they were all expected to be present, and at that moment a bell rang out to summon all to the meeting. Representatives from all the free peoples living in Middle-earth have all made their way to Rivendell, each apparently making the trip on their own separate matters of business. Just a coincidence that they all ended up here for this, as it turns out. Elrond had called them to this council to speak for their people concerning the Ring of Power and the threat of imminent invasion by the Dark Lord Sauron. Frodo was introduced to several elves, dwarves, and men, almost none of whom he knew personally. Gloin, a dwarf from Erebor, informed the council that a messenger from Sauron had entreated with Dane the Second, Ironfoot, king under the mountain, asking for news about Bilbo and the ring that he had possessed, which had apparently once belonged to the Dark Lord of Mordor. For its return, Sauron promised to return to Dane three of the seven rings given to the dwarves long ago. Dane, however, mistrusted the messenger's words and had sent Gloin with his son Gimli to seek Elrond's advice. Elrond responded that the time had come to tell the full tale of the ring, which Sauron sought above all else, so that all present could understand the danger it represented. So here we go. We're getting the full tale of the ring. After Glenn's account, Boromir, representing his father, the steward of Gondor, told a dream he and his brother Faramir had each experienced months before. In this dream, the eastern sky had grown dark, but out of the west a light had shone forth, and from the light a voice had called out, saying, "Seek for the sword that was broken. In Imladris it dwells. There shall be taken counsels, stronger than mortal spells. There shall be shown a token, that doom is near at hand. For Isildur's bane shall awaken, and the halfling forth shall stand." At Boromir's words, the ranger called Strider produces the broken sword, the sword Narsil, heirloom of the heirs of Isildur. He reveals himself to be Aragorn, son of Arathorn, the last surviving blood heir to the ancient kings of Gondor and Arnor. Frodo, the halfling of the Rime, then produces the ring, and Boromir expresses amazement, wondering how such a powerful thing had come to such an unlikely possessor. Bilbo then told everyone how he took the ring from Gollum. Gandalf subsequently explained how Gollum himself came to possess the ring, and how it had been both lengthened his lifespan and driven him to great evil. Gandalf also revealed that his search for knowledge about the true nature of Bilbo's magic ring had led him to both search for Gollum so as to interview him, and also to discover a scroll written by Isildur himself that described the ring and how to recognize it by its fiery letters. By this information, Gandalf had been able to positively identify the ring as the ruling ring, and learn that if Sauron regained it, all the west lands of Middle-earth would be covered in a second darkness. At a question from Boromir, Aragorn told how he captured Gollum and brought him to the elves of Mirkwood for safekeeping, but an elf named Legolas, son of Thranduil, king of the woodland realm, announces that Gollum had escaped, seemingly with the aid of orcs. Serious as this development was, however, it paled beside the worst news Gandalf was relating, the treason of Isengard. He went on to tell how he himself had been held captive by Saruman, the head of the White Council, and head of the Order of Wizards. Unfortunately, Saruman's long study of the Rings of Power had corrupted him, and he had been seduced by the lust for power. Having finally deduced that the One Ring had been found, Saruman intended to gain it for himself, and thus supplant Sauron as master of Middle-earth. For this purpose, while Frodo was preparing to leave the Shire for Rivendell, Saruman had lured Gandalf to his fortress of Orthanc in the Vale of Isengard, hoping to learn from him the ring's precise whereabouts. When Gandalf refused to tell Saruman, he was imprisoned atop the pinnacle of Orthanc, but eventually Gwyr, a great eagle, rescued himself and took him to Rohan, where he befriended and tamed the great horse Shadowfax, who speedily took him north again. "Why couldn't you just take him there, Gwyr, directly?" Anyway, he speedily took him north again, this time in pursuit of the Black Riders heading for the Shire. That is how Gandalf, in time, had come to be at Rivendell with Frodo and his companions. The council finally discussed many ways of dealing with the ring, but none seemed satisfactory. Boromir suggested using the ring against Sauron to defeat him, but the corrupted power of the ring would only create a new Dark Lord to enslave Middle-earth. Those who dwelt beyond the Sundering Seas would not receive the ring either, nor could it be hidden away forever against the might of Sauron's army. With no other hope of victory, Elrond declared, and the others present agreed, some reluctantly, that the only course left was to destroy the ring in the only way possible, by carrying it into the very heart of Mordor and dropping it into the fires of Mount Doom, where it had been forged. But who was to carry the ring was another point of decision. Bilbo, despite his advanced age, valiantly volunteered to finish what he had begun, but Gandalf declared that it was a task beyond the old hobbit's strength. Bilbo could not take back the ring. It was then Frodo who, almost against his will, finally volunteered to continue his quest and destroy the ring. At this point, Samwise Gamgee, Frodo's gardener and faithful companion, who had sat in on the whole council in secret, burst out in protest, asking Elrond whether Frodo would be sent out alone. Elrond replied that no, Samwise at least would go as well, saying wryly, "It is hardly possible to separate you from him, even when he had been summoned to a secret council, and you have not." So there we go, the Council of Elrond. So the main purpose of this chapter is to, as is said, recount the whole history of the ring. So we get everyone here talking about that, and we get everything, the different details from the different people, like Gandalf explaining that, of course, Gandalf and Elrond explaining that, of course, it started with Sauron, and then it was cut from his hand by Isildur, and he took it for himself, because he, the weakness of men, as we say. instead of destroying it, and he kept it and lost it.
Why shouldn't he keep it, Zach?
Why shouldn't I keep it? Yeah. And he lost it, he died, and it went into the river and was lost for thousands of years before it was picked up by Gollum. He took it, and then Bilbo got it, and then, of course, it ended up with Frodo. So that's the story of the ring.
I mean, I love the hell of all this in this chapter, honestly. I mean, first of all, like, the way Tolkien writes is just a lot of fun, you know, and they're like, you know, they show Gandalf, oh, well, what are you doing here, Gandalf? You know, where's Saruman? I mean, of course, he writes it more eloquently than that, but basically these people are like, I don't know if you're the expert wizard on this, and Gandalf's like, sit down, all right? I gotta tell you the whole thing. All this is going to be answered. Obviously, dude is crazy. You know, like, news travels so slowly that, I mean, obviously, like, Saruman's been up to stuff for quite a while. But, you know, I don't know. And I do love that his explanation was like, no one's ever going to find that shit, man. It was in the rivers in the ocean now. I mean, probably, sure. But, like, they just accepted that for thousands of years?
Yeah, a little lackadaisical, perhaps. Whatever. Not a big deal. Yeah.
And we get his Technicolor dream coat that they don't show in the movie, unfortunately.
Alas.
So.
Yeah, it's nice, as you say, because information is not immediate. There's no internet or email. So you have to come together in a big council and just explain what the hell was going on this whole time. Like, everyone...
Right, it's not, like, such forced exposition as it could be.
Yeah, it is definitely reader, expository.
Right. But, like, this is a lot of useful stuff for the reader if you've never read these books.
Or, absolutely.
I mean, especially if you've never read The Hobbit, you're like, I don't know what's going on, really.
Yeah, it's just interesting to get... Like, it's all very interesting, and it's organized around this principle of... We have this mission, and we got to figure out what to do. It's not just random information. It's all comes together in a really cool way, and just getting this fuller knowledge of the world.
But the plan is, like, we're just going to send Frodo and, oh, of course, his buddy. That's, like, the whole plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
plan's not great.
At this point is a bit flimsy.
There wasn't a whole big plan.
It's a false plan, right? They're just challenging these people to join up for the Fellowship, but they can't say it. I mean, like, yeah, we're going to send them out unprotected. And everyone's like, what?
And even, like, it wasn't like they came up with that. It was like, all right, Frodo, I'm going to do it. Like, guys, shut up. I'm going to do it, okay? I got this.
Yeah, they'll work out the details later. But, yeah, all of this exposition is really well structured because it's not like they have regular messengers between, like, Rivendell and Mirkwood and the dwarves, and all these people came with problems of their own that they wanted to let people know were happening, and it just so happens that they're all related and all have to do with the ring. So, like, I can give Elrond the benefit of the doubt that, like, he didn't know all of these people would be here specifically, and the idea of the Fellowship, I think, comes after Frodo volunteers, and they're like, wait, we can't just send one hobbit or two hobbits alone. That won't work. Who do we have here that we can send with them? And it sort of builds from there.
I thought Elrond called for some of these people, though. Like, intentionally, right?
It's a weird mix.
The same people who have stuff to tell are, like, Legolas, who came because Gollum escaped, and Glowin,
right,
who came because he got a message from Sauron, and
Boromir, who came because of his dream that he had in Fairyhood. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, who gets dreams with, like, full-on poems recited, and, like, both brothers get the same...
It happens.
That's completely wild. But anyway.
Well,
the poem part is particularly funny. Like, you can have a...
That it's in verse.
Dream that's kind of foreshadowing something, and you're thinking, okay, so I need to go there, and that would be almost okay. But the poem, like, the prophecy in your dream is a bit...
Like, yeah. It's like watching Inside Out. They got, like, the dream management people. They're having, like, a poetry jam or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, perfect. Dang.
It all ties to this idea of like fate. It's all fate that brought them here at this moment, etc. Like even Elrond kind of notes that like this was destined to happen.
I mean, especially in this book up to this point, there's not like it's not like Star Wars. You have the Force, so there's nothing that is like that we're supposed to believe is guiding people, you know. So it's all just like, oh, this is all kind of random. I mean, obviously they're all dealing with Sauron and looking for the ring, but like, yeah, some of that's a bit like, what caused all this? It just happened.
All right. So that's kind of the primary thing we go through is that story about the ring, which I like because it's actually kind of cool to see the characters figure out. It's like a little like forensic investigation. It's like that kind of thing where it's like finding out like how they piece together the story of the ring. I don't know. It's kind of fun to just see the pieces come together that way to kind of like solve the mystery of the ring and how it got here, because it's like it wasn't obvious. Like this thing was gone for thousands of years. There's no reason why Gandalf would have been able to make the connection between the Ring of Power and the ring that Bilbo ends up with. Like there's no inherent,
right? It just looks like a ring.
Yeah,
I mean, and why would you assume that it's that ring?
It was basically just Bilbo being weird that Gandalf was like, all right, I gotta look into this.
Right, because, Bilbo had it for, how long? Like, 50 years or something like that? And, yeah. There wasn't anything in the lore that, at least that Gandalf knew, or I don't know if even anyone knew, about, like, the One Ring makes you invisible. Like, no one knew anything about that. So, I don't know. I'm trying to think, though, didn't he write The Hobbit first, and then he came back and did and kind of, like, re-edited some of this?
That sounds like, right, yeah.
I don't think he intended, like, that ring in The Hobbit to be, like, this, as big as it was. I don't know, it might have been in his head, I can't remember now, but...
Yeah, I really like those things where, like, the mystery is put together, you put all the pieces together, and I think that is a nice organizing principle of this chapter that makes it feel less like an exposition dump. So we learn, of course, that Saruman is a bad guy, and we kind of get that retelling of his encounter with Gandalf and just how far he has seemingly fallen. And I'm just curious about Saruman as a character, as a villain, and what he represents to you guys as this other wizard who ostensibly is the greatest among them, but who fell prey to the seduction, or rather the overwhelming, in his opinion, just sort of power of Sauron and the fact that he seems destined for victory, and just generally like what this character is about. Curious what you guys think.
I mean, it's not surprising, like someone's got to turn evil, right? I don't know. Saruman's the imposter.
Saruman's the imposter.
He's mad sus, y'all.
Mad sus.
But that's sort of the point I was about to make is I think Saruman's probably been sus for like decades. So like it's not like overnight he decided, and I mean he's obviously extremely smart and powerful, but they call him Saruman the Wise. But like Gandalf should have I mean he even berates himself for it. Like he should have seen something was going on. Like he didn't do this overnight.
Too busy with the pipe weed.
Like they have meetings every week. Like they don't see each other all that much.
Right.
Meet up every 7 years or
Shire, doesn't he? But yeah. I mean, wouldn't there be like kind of like signs and portents from like just stuff happening in that area? You think you would have heard something at some? I don't know. Back then, whole armies used to just like sneak in through forests, and you're like, "Oh my gosh, we're at war! I didn't know we were at war."
Yeah, no satellite.
We're at war now.
That just doesn't happen now. How many wars
drones?
Were solved because people were just really sneaky? Nowadays, it's like my tanks are on the border. They're like, "Hey, what are you doing?" "Oh, this is just exercises. All right, we're gonna go home. They caught us, guys. War averted. They caught us."
I mean, more seriously on Saruman, I actually didn't remember that it was that well described in the book how he turns evil, and like even in the movie the scene is not as he doesn't say everything he says in the book.
He's here. Very blunt here about what needs to happen.
Yeah, he is, and I found that interesting. But yeah, that's basically it. He is the villain that we get to see and interact with, which is not really the case of Sauron.
Sauron's a big eyeball.
Yeah.
It's hard to talk with a big eyeball.
He's like, you could do well here in Slytherin. You know?
Yeah. He's join me and we can rule the galaxy, etc. which of course Gandalf doesn't do. All right. Any other things to say? All right, I want to note the actual line that we get from Frodo where he volunteers. He says, I will take the ring, though I do not know the way. I just love this. It's one of my favorite lines in the series. And I think it's just the perfect encapsulation of Hobbit courage, because, of course, he could have said, like, I will do this. It's on me. I'm on it. But when he says, I do not know the way, like, it's an acknowledgement of the fact that he is not one of those sort of great and noble people that knows exactly what he has to do. He doesn't know what to do, but he's going to do it anyway. And that's what's special about him. And right. That's why he was the right person to do
he's
this.
He's saying, I'll do as much as I can. Yeah. Like, whatever that is, I don't know, but I'll do it.
I don't know what this is going to be like. I really am lost and I'm not sure and I'm scared, but I'm going to do it. And that's great. Like, that makes the choice hard. And yet he is the one to step up and do that. So, like we were talking about before, I think sometimes we view this as a foregone conclusion that Frodo the whole time was going to be the one to go on the quest, but that's not the case. It wasn't destined. He chose. Like, that's key. That he said, I'm going to do it. It wasn't, you have to do this, Frodo. I think that's a essential distinction.
I wonder though, I mean, if Frodo doesn't volunteer here and if Frodo says, I got to go back home, I can't do this, I mean, he's already sort of, you know, throwing a grenade on his home life, but I don't know, like, who else none of them want to take it, right? They don't trust the people that want to take it. Like, I don't know what options they would have
had. Maybe at some point Elrond would be like, actually, Frodo, you have to. But that's not what happened. Yeah. That's the key thing.
I was expecting you to volunteer, and if you didn't, I was really going to use some of that, like, mind magic to influence you.
Give you a dream and poem that will make you need to do it. Yeah.
There's the idea that you don't want to have too many ring bearers, and it has to be Frodo, because no one else really will volunteer to take on this. I mean, no one is humble enough. Those who would want to take it, you should not give it to them. And Frodo has it, and he didn't know what he had at first, and that makes all the difference. So, yeah, it was the logical conclusion, but I like that it is indeed his choice. Although it's not very, you don't get his whole thought process to get to that, okay, I will take the ring. So that's a bit of a shame, but it feels kind of natural.
All right, any last thoughts on the Council of Elrond? All right, let's move forward.
Have my axe.
Here we go. That's never actually said.
Yeah, we don't get that. That's a shame.
It's not in the books.
Gimli never speaks here.
There are a lot of lovely things that Jackson put in the movies, in these movies, that really did kind of work and are great.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah, they're very different, but I like them both.
I thought that Boromir was much more of an asshole in this chapter than I remember in the movie.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
I always think Boromir, and I kind of noted this later, I think Boromir comes across way worse in the movie than the books. But that's really? Might just be, yeah. Like,
not in this chapter, I don't think, but overall, yeah. I agree. I think in this chapter, in the movie, he's mostly chill. I mean, when he's like, give it to Gondor, but like, for the most part, like, you don't really know what's going on with him in this scene.
Yeah, and here he's all
here,
like, he's not very likable.
Fucking pull him in his dream, like.
Yeah, so listen, I'm here because I've got a poem.
How much more annoying can you get?
Fair enough. All right, let's go ahead and jump to chapter 3. And Mary, you want to take us through this summary for The Ring Goes South?
Yeah, I will. So, okay. After the council meeting, the hobbits held a meeting of their own. You're right, Zach. It's weird to have this in the past tense, but yeah, we'll make it. So Merry and Pippin were offended that Sam had been chosen to accompany Frodo and not them. Gandalf told them that scouts had been sent out to gather information about the Black Riders and that Frodo could not leave unless they come back with news. Gandalf told Frodo that he might accompany him, but for now Frodo had to remain at Rivendell and help Bilbo with a book of records he was completing. It's not a book, it's Bilbo's book. Weird phrasing. The Hobbits remained at Rivendell for 2 months, by which time the scouts began to return. No news was to be had of the Black Riders from any direction, except a few lost horses, like dead horses, and torn cloaks. It was decided that Frodo must leave at once, accompanied by Sam and Gandalf. Elrond also decided that they should increase their numbers to 9 in order to match the Black Riders. Legolas would represent the elves, Gimli, son of Glóin, would represent dwarves, and Aragorn would represent men. Since Aragorn's path to Minas Tirith would lead with them, Boromir would also go along. Reluctantly, Pippin and Merry.
That's the ship.
yeah, we're allowed to go. Because, as Pippin says, you need someone intelligent on this quest. That's actually in the book.
And Pippin's got some killer lines in this.
Yeah. Aragorn's broken sword was reforged and named Andúril, the Flame of the West. Bilbo gave Frodo a small knife named Sting and a shirt of mithril armor to be worn under his clothes, because he might look silly if he wears it outside. Each traveler brought their personal weapon, and Sam convinced everyone to take Bill the pony as well. So they set out with the understanding that, except for Frodo, each was free to leave the party whenever he chose. And I almost had the reflex of saying he or she, because I'm trying to be inclusive these days, but yeah, no women, so that's not going to happen.
Nope.
So, yeah, not here. So they reached the ruins in Holland, and the first stage of their journey was complete. Strider felt like they were being observed by someone and noticed Black Cribbane out of Dunland and Fangorn flying low over the land. The group decided to leave, and at one point even saw a dark shadow pass over the land. Later, the company reached Caradhras, one of the three mountains of Moria. They attempted to reach the Redhorn Gate and thus descend the mountain near Miramir. That's a weird word. The snow was very deep at the pass, however, and soon their escape was barred by a large drift. Aragorn and Boromir forced a path through it and carried the hobbits back to safety, while the rest walked or rode Bill the pony through that path. Poor pony. And that's where we stop. Yeah.
Yes.
That's the end of the chapter.
You nailed the pronunciations. Ooh, impressive. I'm jealous.
Everyone can leave but you, Frodo.
Yeah. So actually, can I talk about this? Because I really love this little bit of philosophy when they leave, and Elrond is like, okay, so you're free to go and to stop this quest whenever you need to, because that's okay. And I kind of like that, especially because I like his sentence when he says, Elrond, I mean, let him not vow to walk in the dark who has not seen the night fall. I think that's very poetic, and that's very nicely said. And I understand why Elrond is saying that, but at the same time, I love. I think I'm personally more like Gimli, and I would be like, you have to be loyal and have like honor and stay true to what you said you were gonna do. Otherwise, what's this company about? If everyone is just free to, I mean, what does this mean for Frodo? It's quite. He's willing to make the ultimate sacrifice and go all the way, and everyone else is like, okay, you can leave whenever you want.
Right. So I'm gonna stop here. I'm good.
Okay. I
feel like the leave whenever you want is a necessity thing, because they don't know each other very well. So it's sort of like you only want people with you that you know you can trust, and if they decide at some point, maybe I'm not into this, it's like, well, I don't really need you here anyway then.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree. I think Elrond's point of if you force everyone to take a vow now, it might break you, but like, spoiler alert, they broke anyway. And also the fact that Aragorn and Boromir were not even supposed to go all the way with them, because they're only like going, could it make sense,
right,
because they're going to Minas Tirith anyway. It's a bit, yeah, it's not as clear as we imagine it is, this all leaving into the adventure, you know. It's okay, so these guys are going to go with you, but actually they might just stop, and they are just going because it's the same road, basically. It's, yeah.
I will say that when you said, like, Elrond is saying, like, oh, we got to make sure there's 9 people to, you know, so that you can, you know, match up against the 9 ring wraiths, it's like, isn't that exactly the logic of a machine?
I mean, why? Like,
yeah,
why
whatever.
They have to be 9.
It's kind of BS because not all of them are matched against a ring wraith.
Like, oh, Mary can take a ring wraith, guaranteed.
You don't expect them to like meet head on with the 9.
It's not like a 9v9 duel that are getting set up.
but in his mind, he's like, yes, this is great. 9 fighters. 9 enemy, you know, hunters? Perfect. Like, no.
Yeah, it's really just some, like, numerology fantasy shit, whatever. It's like, we need this specific number
right.
for
Well, because, like, in
reasons.
The Hobbit, they're like, we have to have one more, or else, because they were going to be, what, they were going to have 13, and that was going to be a bad number, so.
Right, exactly. It's that kind of stuff. So, what do we think about the other members of the Fellowship? We kind of invited this Boromir discussion about like how we feel about him as a character and how he compares to the movie. So I think, like, for me, like, I think Boromir, and of course he has that sort of like air of nobility, etc., of men, but I, like, for me, like, he comes across more as just like a nice guy in the books. Like, he's like trying to help, like, at the pass of Caradhras. He is the one who, like, picks up Frodo from the snow and, like, helps him get out. Like, it feels like he's actively taking more of a role in actually being a positive force, whereas, like, and it's just, like, of course, what we see in the movie is very limited, but, like, there's, like, the one scene where, like, he's sparring with Merry and Pippin and he, like, hits them. Like, it feels like they're trying to, like, set him up as being a bad guy.
100%. The movie, they're like, do you see that side eye? He's looking at the
Hobbit. Yeah, and they have the whole scene where he picks up the ring in the snow, like that whole thing. Like, they're setting it, they're like really, they're signaling really hard that he's a bad dude. But I don't know.
I guess they don't want you to be as shocked when he kind of turns. But then, like, maybe like setting it up that way makes it a little bit more poignant when he comes to his senses a little bit later and is like, no, I'm going to protect, you know, Merry and Pippin. I don't know.
Yeah, because in the books it's really sudden where he likes, like, give me the ring, like it's him being overcome by the influence of the ring very suddenly, whereas at every other point
which
in time,
which is understandable, I mean, most people would be.
Yeah,
I mean, I think in the movie the point is to drive home quite clearly that this ring has a huge influence on people and that it is really the ring that's responsible for Boromir being who he is and doing what he does at the end of the first movie. And it's like in the book, it's there, but it's not as clear, just because you don't have the same way of showing that.
Yeah, you do in a movie, you kind of have to have these cues that set things up. It's just a different approach, I think. But yeah, I don't know, just like up to that point.
I don't blame either one.
Yeah. I'd agree. I think up to that point, though, in the book, like, Boromir, for me, just comes across as, like even, like, Aragorn to say, like, he is a man of great valor, etc. Like, it's clearly signaled that he's, like, a good dude throughout, I feel. And there's not that setup of...
He's just got a lot on his shoulders, you know?
Dude. Yeah.
Got high expectations.
So, yeah. That's Boromir. What about Gimli and Legolas? They're also quite different than how they are portrayed in the films. So, of course, in the films, they're, like, the main comedy with their, like, counting and all that shit.
Yeah. It really works well the way they play
it's
the romance
great.
In the films and all
You'll
that.
Have to toss
I really
me
like them in
yeah,
the books.
Good. Yeah. In the books, the relationship is actually much deeper, and we won't get to explore that for a while, but they, like, in the books, like, they go and travel the world together after.
Yeah, they're besties.
Yeah, so, like, I like that. Like, I think that's a lot more developed in the books. Like, I mean, it's fine in the movies. Like, it's good. Like, they have a nice relationship. And it's nicely set up how, like, they start out hating each other, of course, because they have this, like, built-in sort of distrust. But they learn to really appreciate each other. I just think it's a lot more deep in the books, it feels to me. Like, there's moments, like, when they explore the caves and in Helm's Deep, that whole sequence I think is really important for their relationship, and that just doesn't happen in the movie. So,
oh yeah, that's such a, yeah, that's such a great bit there, because it also gives you a lot more about, you know, people at Rohan and you know, the common interests they share, and you don't really get those moments to kind of stop and breathe so yeah, much.
Like it's more just like banter, which is fine.
Oh, I killed another one, which is fine. Yeah. I mean, this is the issue of obviously book to movie is like, you know, there was a battle and things were terrible and they overcame. It's like two paragraphs. And like in the movie, they're like, well, that needs to be like our entire act three.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So the battles are very different. Yeah, like the, we'll get to it, but like the Pelennor Fields battle is so different than it is in the movie. And it'll be interesting to explore that. Yeah.
I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about Legolas is to see how different he is from the other elves, and that's more, you can see that more in the previous chapters, but you get a little how his race of elves, if I can call them that, is not the same as Aeron's or the dudes from the Havens. And it feels like he is a little bit more, I don't know if he's more sensitive and at the same time you don't, maybe a bit more connected to what's going on, because they are dealing with war maybe more than the elves at Rivendell. And I found that interesting, the way he's described. It's an in a few words, like you don't get a whole history of the elves and how the wood elves are not the same as the whatever elves. I'm not very knowledgeable.
The Elrond elves. I don't know either what they're called.
Yeah, those filthy wood elves. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I just enjoy them both a lot more. Like, there's the whole comment about how in the movies Legolas never talks to Frodo. So it's like kind of weird. But
he doesn't?
I think so, yeah. They never have a direct interaction.
I can see that. Orlando Bloom, jerk.
That's not why. It's just they just never had reason to communicate. Yeah. Like, this, they're just like, you get more time to develop the relationships in the party, I think, here. So that's a thing. What else was I good? Oh, Gimli, though. Like, there's some weird stuff with Gimli we'll get to soon. Like, him taking the three hairs of Galadriel and like obsessing over her. It's kind of weird, but
hey, it wasn't weird back then, it was sweet back then.
Sure.
Okay?
It leads to some of my absolute favorite unintentional comedy.
You sniff hair sweetly back then. You can't do that anymore.
Some of my absolute favorite unintentional comedy in the books is, it's like at the very end when they're in Minas Tirith after they won, where Gimli is like, if you say anything bad about Galadriel, I will kill you. Like, just like,
you're like, oh, this guy's a stalker. How old, like, is what? Gimli? What is he, like 50, 60? Or?
I don't know. Something like that.
He's like young for a dwarf.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was like a kid in The Hobbit, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because Gloin's like and a young lad at that point.
Maybe.
He wasn't old enough to go on that quest, is the idea, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and like Gloin has a little portrait of him and
movie.
His wife.
Yeah.
And the elves make fun of it. And yeah, so I don't know how long it is from The Hobbit to here, but maybe 60 years.
About 60, yeah.
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 Actually, it's more. It's like 70 something. 78,
how,
whatever.
How old was Bilbo when he left in The Hobbit?
Bilbo was in his like 50s, I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was.
He was, yeah. 50s, well, so we know he's 111.
And then, oh yeah,
he's 111 not anymore, now. Right? Because there's like.
Oh, then 17 years passed. That's what I'm saying. So it's like 70 something years.
Yeah, that's true. You forget sometimes.
And just 17 years pass.
Yeah.
All right.
Sauron's like, you know, I should move my army in 3 or 4 years.
Hey, it's a big army. It takes time to muster, you know?
You got to call the banners and oaths of loyalty. Yeah.
That's another thing that kind of gets lost in the movies. You get it in spurts, but like, there's a huge array of followers of Sauron. Like, we even get mentioned here, like the Haradrim and all that. Like, there's a bunch of people than just like orcs. It's not just orcs that are on the side of evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's evil men and some
which is again reductive, like evil men, like why are they evil? Yeah. But yeah, we don't have to get into that whole deal.
My favorite part is like, yeah, the evil men.
Yeah. All right, any thoughts? I just want to stop and do a little nerdy fantasy sword conversation. Any thoughts on Anduril, the Flame of the West, and just in general, like, where does this rank among the best fantasy swords?
Narsil like 2.
Yes, Narsil, Reforged. Yeah,
but, like, the name is prettier than Narsil.
I agree. Narsil's a little meh.
I mean, this is 100% the influence of like, you know, the movies and stuff. But personally, like, I always like Glamdring.
Glamdring's my favorite.
Gandalf's sword is super cool, and like the way they made it in the movies, I think it looks a lot cooler.
It looks amazing.
Not that Narsil and stuff isn't cool. It just seems like somewhat basic to me. Thorin's sword, Fauhamrond. Yeah, Orcrist.
Great too. Right? Yeah.
Which like I don't really like the way they did that in the movie, but like I always kind of thought that was a cooler blade, just like in my own imagination.
Yeah, I love the name Anduril, but the name Glamdring and also that it's Fauhamrond is just so cool. I love that. Man. I love that.
Yeah, that's badass.
Yeah.
I think if we are still comparing or at least discussing books and movies, and that it's a smart move on Peter Jackson here to have moved like the reforging of the blade to the third movie, because it just wouldn't have had the same impact right there when they leave, when the Fellowship leaves Rivendell.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, we made the blade.
We've been trying to be like, surprise, right here. And you're like, what?
Yeah, it hits much harder at that point in the story. Yeah. Where it's like, here it's like, oh, you have a sword now.
Yeah, that's it. All right.
I always forget like that this is where Frodo gets Sting. Like, because I know, like, they get the knives earlier. But in my head, I'm like, oh, didn't Bilbo just leave that to him? Like, no. Bilbo took the sword with him. Like, oh, yeah. That's right.
Sting is another great one. Just really iconic.
Like, Frodo's sword, broke when they were at the fort, and I don't really understand how his sword breaks, especially since, like, he didn't really fight anyone with it.
It's the power of the Nazgul.
Or right.
I mean, they weren't great blades, right?
No,
it's confusing. It's really those blades, the Barrow blades, are really confusing because like there's the whole thing about was it the Barrow blade that killed the Witch King or was it Eowyn? Like, what actually killed the Witch King? Like, whatever. We'll get to that.
All right. Yeah, we will.
Yeah. It sometimes they just seem like basic daggers. Other times they're like there's specifically what could kill the Witch King or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Sometimes the rules for things in the Tolkienverse aren't so defined.
Yeah.
Someday when this all becomes like public domain and people write the shit out of stories, like I bet that'll change. So like, actually, Glamdring is a +5.
Yes. It's got good magic stats.
I need to leave in like 10 minutes, but I do have a question. In this chapter, it's so you've got all the scouts going out and coming back, and there's a mention of Elrond's sons, Eladin and Elrohir. Yeah,
yes.
I've written it down just to be
nicely clear. Done.
and there's like a whole lot of secrecy around where they went and what they found, and no one else than Elrond got to hear their reports, and I was just wondering what's that about.
Like,
it's shady.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hmm.
I don't know.
I used to use those guys' names for like video game characters and stuff when I create a character.
I used Eomir. And I even put the accent on his E. That was really
But if you look into it, like they don't get mentioned much except for like that they're super capable and they've got like, you know, great weapons and they're like these like really badass elves.
Don't they
like,
go with Aragorn to find the army of the dead and all that?
Yes.
They're the ones who come with
him. Well, actually, Dúnedain come and help him.
The Dúnedain, yeah.
I can't remember. I think they might do. I don't remember. We'll get to
it. I thought one of them was there, but I don't remember which one. But yeah, you hear about like them, their travels and stuff, but like you don't really get a good idea of actually what they get up to.
Yeah, yeah. And since apparently you don't know, I'm going to Google it because I need to know what they were doing right there that we cannot know about, apparently.
They were on a mission with the Blue Wizards.
You know. Secret ops, black ops, blue ops. All right. I think one of my favorite things in this chapter is just how, like we were talking about before, like there's so many reversals and setbacks as they're trying to move forward. Like it feels like the land itself, and they remark on this, has turned against them, either because of the will of the enemy or just the land is mean. Like they talk about how, like Caradhras is like just a really mean mountain that likes to mess with people.
Man, this mountain's an asshole.
This mountain's the worst.
It definitely feels that way. Like the whole trek through the snow, it feels so like realistic. Like you can feel how long and cold and wet it is. Like I do not.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't do that anymore. Like people like they climb Everest for fun, whatever. And now it's a tourist trap with like trash everywhere. But like we used to be like, well, someone's got to go over that pass. Like we had
We gotta chart this.
Like to chart it or to bring supplies or a message or whatever. It wasn't that long ago that we would actually be in these kind of weird outlier places, and you know there were people that were trained to do that. Now when you have this stuff like you know up the sled dogs and all that, like you know a lot of it's kind of more tradition and whatnot than utility. So like I think a lot of us has forgotten, like no one's going out in the winter and like we see like a beautiful mountain at the ski resort and like
you know, I'm gonna ski down that for fun.
Yeah, like you look at a cliff face, you might go, well, I'll just walk up that. Like you could die like very easily.
Oh yeah,
like even with the right gear.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, like, just, there's no interstate, you know, there's no, like, path or tunnel that you can just, like, okay, we're good. So, yeah, they actually have to seriously consider what path they take.
Sort of cut off, like, not, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, they could, you know, build a bridge, you know, like, yeah, you know.
more tunnels.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, you really feel like that the process of getting to this other place is so difficult, which I enjoy. And I think it's another advantage of the books over the movies. It's just that like you really feel that struggle because you just have more time to bask in the pain of it than in a movie where like the stuff resolves in like 5 minutes just because of how movies work, which is fine. But again, like it just in a book by its nature, you get to really experience the tension and the struggle as they try to climb this mountain and fail and have to go and start something anew. All right. Any other thoughts on chapter 3? Okay.
Did you mention Sam's pack? And
oh, I did not. If we want to talk about that,
yeah, I love that. I love that. And when he's like, "Oh damn, I don't have rope," and he gets
rope later.
Yeah, he will need the rope, but he will get it from Galadriel. And it seems like the brothers, like the Elrond's sons, probably just went to Lothlorien, and maybe it's not that secret. But I don't know why we kind of know about this.
That's the secret of the series. What happened with Elrond? Yeah, that's it's it. Like, who's the secret Targaryen of this?
Guys, this was fun, and I'm very sorry to miss the rest of it. But some I will problem. Listen back to it, and we can schedule the next one sooner than this one was, probably. Get back into the rhythm. All right.
Thanks for
have
coming.
Fun for the rest of the chapters. See you soon.
See you.
Bye.
All right, let us do these last two chapters here, where we head into Moria. So we have chapter 4, A Journey in the Dark, and chapter 5, The Bridge of Khazad-dûm. All right, summary. Gandalf told the Fellowship that the only way under the mountains was through the mines of Moria, underground tunnels in which a group of dwarves led by Balin had disappeared years ago. When they reached the gates of Moria, The gate stream has been dammed and the entrance was flooded. Finding the runes on the gate, the Fellowship pondered a riddle. The quote, "Speak, friend, and enter." Merry alone of the Fellowship was on the right track, and he helped Gandalf find the answer. Gandalf used the secret password of Melon, as he says in the movie. Melon.
Gandalf's been there before.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I'll mention Gandalf takes a lot of L's in these chapters, to be honest. So he says the password to gain them entrance. Before they could go in, though, they were attacked by a tentacled water creature, the Watcher in the Water, that particularly targeted Frodo. To escape, they all went into the mines, but the Watcher destroyed the entrance behind them. They had no choice but to go forward through the mines. Fissures and chasms made their path treacherous. At one point, they entered a stone doorway and found a deep well inside it. Pippin threw a stone into it out of impulse, Fool of a Took, and they began to hear a tapping, as if someone was using a hammer. They walked on for as long as they could, coming to many paths and crossroads, resting little and eating less. The mines of Moria were famous for silver mithril, and it was in search of this that Balin and his dwarves had come to Moria. Gandalf told them that Bilbo had a coat of mail armor made of mithril, and Frodo marveled when he realized that Bilbo had gifted him with a suit of armor with a value worth the whole of the Shire. When they continued on their journey, the next day they came upon a tomb, and Gandalf read what was written on it. They realized that this is the tomb belonging to Balin, son of Frundin. Frodo was sorry when he realized that Bilbo's good friend and companion was dead. From a book of records found within the tomb, Gandalf learned that Balin and the dwarves had recolonized Moria, interesting phrasing, were attacked by orcs, and also by a strange beast with no form or body. Gandalf gave the Book of Mazerbul to Gimli, all paid their respects to Balin's tomb, and left. Suddenly, the orcs returned. After a fierce battle in which Frodo was wounded, Gandalf stopped the orcs with a spell, as if in warning of what is to come. However, a very strong presence nearly made it impossible for Gandalf to use his power. The further they went through the mines, the hotter it became, and they realized that the lower levels were on fire. They came across a deep chasm that could only be crossed by a narrow bridge. Gimli led the way, and just as Legolas drew his bow, he saw a sight that filled him with horror. A great shadow shaped like a man, but having far greater power, was pursuing them. It was a Balrog, known as Durin's Bane, the beast that had attacked Balin and the dwarves. The Balrog had a blade like a stabbing tongue of fire in one hand, and a thong of whips in the other. He leapt across the chasm and raced toward them. Boromir drew out his horn and blew it for some reason. Shortly after, he and Aragorn ran to aid Gandalf, but Gandalf commanded them to return to the rest of the company. Gandalf stood on the bridge and commanded the Balrog to go back, but it rushed at him with its sword. Gandalf countered it with his own sword, and before it could attack a second time, he cut the bridge right out from under the Balrog. Impressive cutting, Gandalf. With a cry, the Balrog toppled into the abyss, slashing its whip at Gandalf. Gandalf became entwined in it and was dragged down as well. So, there goes Gandalf. He's dead for good.
Gandalf! We'll
never know his like again.
Gandalf!
Gandalf!
And then cue the crying.
Etc. Grief. We'll get to the grief. So yeah, I'm just curious, like, what you feel about Moria as a fantasy location, as just a place that we get to go to here.
Every time, whether it's in the book or in the movie, we get to Moria, I'm always just like, I want to see what this place was like. Like, how did it function? What was it like when there were thousands of dwarves living here? Because, you know, they spent a lot of time there. It must have been pretty darn cool.
For sure. And they say it's 40 miles across, I think, at some point, which is huge. It's like a very large city, mm-hmm. but just underground. And we kind of lose the sense of time while they're in it because there's no day and night, but they spend the equivalent of several days just crossing it, and they're going pretty fast because they're not stopping a lot for sleep. So, yeah, it would have had a lot of people in it, I think, at the time where it was not the home of a Balrog. Or maybe it was always the home of a Balrog.
They just dredged it up from the darkness. Yeah. They dug too greedily and too
Dwells were too greedy.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that's what's cool about it. What you guys are saying is that it has this sense of history to it, this sense of being this place that used to, like, again, I say this like every time on these podcasts, but one of my favorite things about Lord of the Rings is that everything has a weight of history to it, and this feeling that it used to be this great place and now it has fallen into ruin, and this is just one more example of that. And I think it's just cool to have, in particular, this ancient underground city. It's just such a cool concept. And I think that it's just really appealing to get to experience that as a part of the story and to go through that. Of course, it's a horrific location, and that's part of what makes it fun to read. It's just this like very particular kind of experience they have going through this huge dark ruin, essentially, of a great kingdom that once existed. I think that's just fun. I enjoy that.
Yeah. It's like playing Dragon Age. I mean, obviously the Deep Roads are like modeled after this.
Oh, it's very similar.
I always chose like the dwarf to start because I really enjoyed that. But like you would get like the little areas in the Deep Roads where like, oh, you found kind of like an undiscovered area that was untouched. And that's why I always kind of imagine like there's probably just whole areas of Moria that are just like, you know, basically like you clean the cobwebs off and everything's still there, you know. Yeah,
and this is like the first time we're really in an abandoned place, because like we've seen the ruins before here and there, but this is a huge city that is completely abandoned and kind of preserved in the state that it was when the last of the dwarves died. Like they come across this book that's not finished and kind of with the writing that trails off as they're being attacked and sort of like frozen in time. Whoa. as they find it.
Yeah,
I feel like it's even more jarring in Moria than in other places. Like when we get to Lorien, we also get really the sense that it's the end of the elves' age and they're getting ready to leave Middle-earth and all that. But here, it's really like it's already happened. There are no more dwarves here.
Yeah, it's a completely different scale, and it's just harrowing to think, like you guys say, it used to be this bustling kingdom. Like just the sheer scale of what was lost is really difficult to reckon with, and that's I think one of the main things about Moria that's so exceptional. So yeah, I mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a small nation, basically.
Yeah.
That was abandoned. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really harrowing to experience every time. Like just like he does a great job, like just in sketching out like how significant it feels. This just huge empty hall. It's really actually like kind of scary that it's the way it is now. So I mentioned in the summary, I have to question Gandalf's sense of navigation in these chapters. He's taken a lot of L's, I'll say. he makes a moment, he even literally says at one point, I have no memory of this place. It's just like, come on, Gandalf.
Yeah.
It's essentially a bit of a miracle that they made it out of here with him leading the way.
Yeah, it really makes you think that he's the one who knows the most about the path that they have to take. Like, I'm really worried for the Fellowship moving forward now.
Now, with that said, I think it is worth noting that this is a really important, as we talked about at the beginning, this is an important turning point in the story, because we really do feel up to this point, as we eventually, of course, lose Gandalf at the end of this chapter, we feel up to this point that things are okay. Like, we're safe. Like, as long as Gandalf's here, we're good. Like, that's going to be fine. But once he's gone, the feeling notably shifts. Like, you just don't have that same sense of direction despite his lack of navigation skills. And that sense of purpose and that sense of safety really takes a hit with him gone. Like, of course, you still have Aragorn and you have these other great people that can defend you. But there's just, like, that palpable feeling that things are not the same. And I think that's important because as we go further on this journey, that keeps progressing and getting more significant. Where eventually, of course, the Fellowship breaks and it's just Frodo and Sam on their own journey, and it's just Merry and Pippin on their journey, etc. And like, you just, as they delve into deeper and darker places, there's less and less of a sense of safety at the same time, because those people that you trusted to protect you aren't there, and you have to kind of protect yourself. Like, that's just a very natural progression that I really like, that we start out like, oh, we're fine, Gandalf's here, and by the end you're like, we're not fine. We're not fine at all. It's just us and a guy who wants to kill us with us navigating us. It's very different.
Yeah. We were talking about how there's no oath for any of the members of the Fellowship apart from Frodo. So it's kind of up in the air whether or not they'll stay together. But until this point, we do have Gandalf, who's kind of the guiding figure in this Fellowship, and everyone seems to look to him to guide them and like know what to do. And even though like they do discuss things together, he kind of has this leadership role, and after he's gone, the decisions seem to be a little more muddy, or like they have to discuss things more, and they kind of procrastinate on making decisions until they get to the falls of Rauros, and we'll discuss what happens then, but they sort of go with the flow after Gandalf is gone, until they come to a point where they have to separate. But it doesn't feel like there's someone intentionally making decisions anymore after Gandalf is gone.
Yeah, it's a very relatable experience too, because I think there are moments in life where you just get to be a follower, and you're just like, all right, cool, someone else is making the direction for me, I'm good, it's easy, I know exactly what I have to do because they're sketching the path for me. But at some points in life, you have to be the leader. You have to be the one making the calls. And that's what changes for a lot of the main characters in the story, is they have to be the ones making decisions. And that's hard. So it's a really nice, like I say,
yeah, progression. Yeah, and they had intended not to. I mean, like someone like Aragorn, you'd say would be like the logical next in line, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, he was going to go to Gondor. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's just, I just love that. I think that that's an underrated element of the progression of the narrative, and really well structured. I have a note here. It's kind of like my Warlock's Maze thing. There's a mention when Gandalf is berating Pippin about the stone in the well. He says, "This is not some hobbit walking party." And I have to know, what is a hobbit walking party? Like, what does that entail? Do you just walk?
So that's the name of my new band.
That's a good name.
Yeah,
I imagine it's when they go walking in the forest to find mushrooms. And
yeah, yeah. It's very peaceful.
And of course, they've got plates of food and drink as they walk.
Yeah, it's just like it's just not a thing I've ever done in my life. I was like, let's go on a walking party.
A walking party. I mean, is that called a hike, or is this?
I guess, kind of, yeah. I guess it's kind of like a hike.
It sounds more relaxed than a hike.
Right.
Yeah, it's more like to me, it invokes like cheeses and bread and like.
Yeah.
This must be, I mean, this, I'm sure people do this. I'm sure it's like, let's walk to the park and have a picnic kind of thing. It's like, I've never planned a walking party.
Yeah, but you gotta have second breakfast on your way there.
It sounds a bit aristocratic too. Like,
it does.
I feel like the queen would have walking parties.
Quite right. Quite right. Yeah.
Well, we've got to get her out for her morning constitutional.
Yes, it's very, very aristocratic vibes from a walking party. Good note there. So yeah, we get this journal from Balin, which I find like in everything that I see this in, like the process of like finding a journal, and this is actually a thing in video games a ton, where you like find a data log or something. It's like such a thing in like horror, where like you slowly see how things descend from like, oh, we're here, we're gonna do our thing, and then it's like, 10 people died. We're running out of food. Like, just like the process of like reading through someone's journal and seeing how things went wrong is so horrifying. It's a really nice structure to slowly build how things went terribly wrong.
Especially when you're like, oh, you shouldn't be writing right now. You should be doing something else.
Yeah, I mean,
save yourself.
This is probably not a priority.
We are being attacked. currently.
Right now.
Where does this well go? Is it possible that you could, like, rope down this well? That might be a good option.
Might have been more proactive, Balin. Alright, so as we get the Balrog's arrival, this is a really nice, ominous set piece, even in the book, where, like, we get the drumbeats of doom, doom, doom. It just really builds the tension of when this great creature from the depths arrives, and we really get this feeling that it's something more terrifying than your average evil creature, because even the orcs are running away. Like, that's such a great way to represent that this is a thing that is on, like, the next level of scary, which I appreciate. Yeah. And of course, I'm not a lore master, but as I understand it, Balrogs are another creation of Morgoth, right? That's the thing. It's one of his primary sort of evil things he did.
Yeah, and they're pretty next level.
Yeah, they're next level evil.
Yeah, they're sort
like,
of on
they don't even care about Sauron, because they're like, that was starry you.
In terms of
divinity.
Right.
Yes.
They're a big deal. And that's why only Gandalf can take them.
The orcs and stuff were already there, right? Like when they showed up to, like, reestablish a colony.
What do you mean? I think the Balrog was when, like, there Balin the longest.
Came, like, well, like the Balrog was already there, but I mean, like, when Balin and his crew came, like, there were
orcs. Yeah, there were orcs there. Like, they came to try to rescue, like, reestablish dwarf presence, and I think, it had already been overrun by orcs and whatnot. I had the thought that this last chapter, the Bridge of Khazad-dûm, would be a really good FCR chapter. I'd love to do that at some point. I think it has a lot of good dialogue and, like, action and stuff. It'd be good.
So obviously Shellfish would have to be Gandalf.
That'd be good. I like that. You cannot pass. It's funny, like, I'm not going to probably leave this in the podcast, but I play a Lord of the Rings card game, like a digital card game, and all the characters, like, when you play the card, have voice lines, and, like, half of the big ones happen in this chapter. Like Gandalf's line, like, you cannot pass. He says, you cannot pass here. You shall not pass. Or Garagwen's like, he cannot stand alone. Like, that's what he says when he's summoned. It's like, all that stuff happens here. It's funny. All right.
And of course, Boromir blows his horn.
That's Boromir's best skill. You know, you gotta blow the horn. It's gonna help. Gotta blow. All right. Any final thoughts on these chapters, or in general, on this section of the Fellowship of the Ring?
One thing we didn't talk about in this chapter, or these two chapters, is that Moria is where Frodo starts to notice that Gollum is following them. But he's not yet aware he senses that someone is following.
He's on the prowl. We'll see him soon enough. I think.
I feel like that's a good parallel to The Hobbit too, because Bilbo met Gollum in a cave with goblins, and now we meet him again in a mine with goblins. So.
It's his favorite spots. He likes those mines and caves. Yeah, that's good. Alrighty, well, I think that will about do it for the latest in the Lord of the Rings reread. Really enjoyed this. Nice to get it going along again. And thank you all very much for joining me for this. This was a ton of fun again. So thanks everyone for listening. If you want to check out more VOK, you can do so at vokpodcast.com. You can check us out on the various social medias, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all those things. And if you want to come chat with us, the best way to do so right now, I think, is to come join us on Discord, which you can find links to on the social media stuff. And that would be great if you want to come chat with us about this stuff or anything else. There's a lot of fun chatting that happens there. So there you go. Thank you all again, and we'll be back again very soon. Bye-bye.